Because the identity and value of a person is inextricably tied to how we tell the story of their lives. And this is directly related to our relationships to God and to each other, because every week you and I gather here to tell and retell the stories of our faith. How do we tell those stories? What does the way we tell the story say about how we understand God and how we value each other? And if the way we treat each other, both within these walls and outside these walls, does not reflect God's value of each one of us, a precious child of God, then we are telling the story the wrong way.
Welcome to another episode of Sermon Podcast Hour with the Collective Table. It's Claire, and today I'm joining Chelsea as we sit down to chat with Pastor Amy Butler.
In this episode, Reverend Claire and I had the chance to sit down with Pastor Amy Butler, a leading female influence and progressive thinker in the church. Pastor Amy received her BA and MA from Baylor University, a BA of Theology from International Baptist Theological Seminary, and a Doctor of Ministry degree from Wesley Theological Seminary. Pastor Amy served as the first woman senior minister at the Riverside Church in New York City. Pastor Amy believes deeply that the courageous community of people who live with tenacious love can change the world. Much of her career has been spent helping build communities of radical witness in the institutional church. She currently leads National City Christian Church as the intentional interim senior minister.
We're so glad you're joining us for this dynamic, inspirational, and important conversation. If you like what you hear, be sure to share it with a friend, give us a like, or even give us a rating. You can also find The Collective Table on Instagram, Facebook, and our website at thecollectivetable.org.
To start our conversation, we wanted to give you a taste of Pastor Amy's sermon with this longer clip. If you'd like to listen to Pastor Amy's full sermon, check out the show notes or visit our website.
The perspective from which you tell a story can change everything. How do you hear your story? What is the role that you have been assigned? Accountant? Youngest child? Immigrant? African American? Working class, educated, woman? Does the story you hear and tell about your life determine for you that you are an underachiever or unworthy or not good enough or unclean or a failure or insignificant? It's so easy for us to take on names like these, even in our subconscious, because we hear over and over messages that we are not good enough, because we see what seems to be evidence of failure all around us, because the details of our lives don't always mirror the expectations of success that our society places upon us, and because other people tell our stories. And these stories, if they're told long enough and loud enough, they evolve into societal structures that oppress and harm and do not reflect God's hopes and intentions for our world. My friends, this is sinful. We are complicit. We have to change the way that the story is told. What would happen if we began to tell the stories of our faith from the perspectives of those who do not have privilege? What if instead of Sarah derided for laughing hysterically, this story becomes one of a voiceless, powerless woman stepping up with joy to her critical role in the work of God in the world? What would that be like? Well, it would be transformational. It would be groundbreaking, and it would be world-shifting. It would be gospel. It would be good news.
If you go to Pastor Amy's website, the first page says, "I am not here to entertain you. I am here to disquiet you. I'm here to make you think. I'm here to make you ask some hard questions." That's my job. And Pastor Amy does just that. Through humor, biblical interpretation, and cultural relevance, Pastor Amy passionately preaches about misogyny, storytelling, and the expansive love of God. She preached this sermon in 2017 at Riverside Church, and it is appropriately entitled Hysterical. We hope you enjoy it. We've been a fan of a lot of your sermons, but we're going to talk about a particular sermon today, Hysterical, what you preached in 2017 on Father's Day, which is just such an interesting, as we get into it more, the theme of the sermon really talks about misogyny and women's roles throughout, you know, scripture and throughout history. And you decided to do this on Father's Day. And I just wonder if you could share with us how that kind of came together for you.
That's so funny. Well, I object to celebrating Father's Day in church or Mother's Day for that matter. So I usually try to ignore it. And honestly, since I'm not a father, it probably was like third or fourth, you know, on the list in my head. To me, it was much more compelling to marry what was going on in the world with the text that I had been assigned to preach, right? And if you remember, it was that week that Kamala Harris was questioning Jeff Sessions and was called hysterical because her questions were making him uncomfortable. So I had that in my head, and that was sort of the lens through which I was reading this story about Sarah, and I had this sudden idea like, oh my gosh, what if we've been reading the story wrong like this whole time? So to me, that was much more of a compelling framework than some Hallmark holiday, right? I did have someone at the door afterwards say to me, well, I'm really disappointed. I came to church today to learn how to be a good father, and you just like didn't offer me that. I was like, I don't know how to be a good father. So I thought what was going on in the world and in the consciousness and minds of all the people who were there in worship was so much more important as a way of connecting them to the text.
I think that's so interesting because I have always struggled to figure out where the line is of celebrating holidays and recognizing those in church, because I do know that people come expecting that, but sometimes, you know, especially Mother's Day and Father's Day can be really, really sensitive topics. And I don't know if I've met someone that just ignored it and but I kind of love that and really admire that.
Well, it was an interesting cultural issue for me because I was pastoring a largely African-American church. And, you know, in history, the church has been the central point of everything in the African-American community, and especially and including honoring mothers and fathers. And so, I had to rethink that a little bit. But in general, I say ignore.
I would argue, though, that you did give. I mean, that you're putting a new way for us to look at the female story throughout time should help someone be a better father, whether you have boys or girls, you know, to be able to have a new framework of which we can, you know, raise women up to be more, or in addition to being a good cook or, you know, whatever. Like the one example of this woman was actually a rocket scientist. And like, that's like 0.5 in her obituary is just wild. And how we really do, you know, assign roles to women that just are so culturally based and not authentic to who we are as people. And I mean, I think that gives them great advice or framework for being a parent, a father.
You would think. and also, you too would understand this. There's so much personal investment in this. Like, can I talk about this without being called like a bitter woman? I had a moment of like real, I don't know, repentance, because like I was constantly preaching about the sins of racism and you know, and I never talked about misogyny because I wanted to prove, you know, like I could do it just as good as everybody else. Like all of us women ministers or anybody, any woman who's in a male dominated field has that pressure. And I just, when I read this story through the lens of what was going on in the world, I thought, you've been wrong. Like, you are not raising this up as a sin of our culture. And it is.
Now, I know you've probably heard this story before. And when you have, it has probably gone something like this. There was this man who desperately wanted a child. His wife failed her because she couldn't get pregnant. So God intervened and promised the child. But upon hearing the news that she would get pregnant, the 90-year-old woman laughed disrespectfully in a somewhat hysterical manner. Maybe today we can tell the story a bit differently. If we look again, conscious of the fact that how we choose to speak of God's work in the world directly impacts the systems that either help us reach or keep us from reaching toward the world that God dreams for all of us.
I couldn't stop thinking about it as I was listening to your sermon, because what I saw the crux of your sermon is kind of identity related to storytelling. And I think it's so beautiful because you point out how the ways that we tell and retell our story says something about how we understand God and value each other. And I think that only you and who you are as a woman could retell and retell that story in that unique way that calls out misogyny. And something I was thinking about too, you talk about it being a sin. I'm really interested in powers and principalities, and I'm wondering if you could speak more on this. I kind of, the way you talked about storytelling, I was wondering in my head, like, I wonder if this twisted the ways that, I think you say misogyny is problematic theological expression. I wonder how comparable that is to a power or principality, and how do we name that and call it out?
Ooh, that's a big question. I think in the preparation for this sermon, I just had this feeling of anger and feeling betrayed a little bit. Like, how come nobody ever told me this story this way before, you know? And it made me think about a couple of different things, like the power that our words have and the power that the way we tell the story has. And, you know, those tools have been used for evil purposes, if you want to say it that way, you know, ingraining in our systems this sort of bias and inability to see the fullness of God in each other because we tell these stories this way. You know, I keep thinking back to when I was a little kid going to Sunday school. Like, Sarah was the bad one who was laughing at God behind the tent flap. Like, wait a second, did you guys lie to me? Like, what? Yes. I do think that the way we tell our stories can be used for evil.
Whenever that happens for you, you start to see a scripture story or verse differently. What does that do to your framework or your, like, you know, it starts to poke hole in a good way, I think, poke holes in, like, well, how I understood, if this story was told to me in this way, and I'm starting to see it differently, like, what does that do to the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And for those of us who have lived through a massive, like, sea change in the way that we view the world or in our theological perspective, we understand what that's like. I grew up, you know, in an evangelical home. My parents are very conservative evangelicals, and I'm the black sheep of the family. And so, you know, that shift, as I'm sure you understand, was so painful, of like taking things that I thought I knew and learning to see them in another way. It's been painful and grace-filled, you know? And honestly, isn't that always what living in relationship with God should be?
And I think that's the role of preacher, right, though, is to start to poke, like, not in an aggressive way, maybe sometimes in an aggressive way, but to kind of, like, ask these questions of, like, how are we viewing scripture? How are we honestly reading it? To kind of, you know, bring some of that out for people. because it is painful and difficult to do on your own. You know, that's why we do faith and community, because, you know, some of those shifts are can be rock our boats pretty wild.
I'm glad you brought us back around to that, because I wanted to say that, you know, I'm currently preaching a series in the book of James, and I tweeted something this week about, like, why did I decide to preach the epistle? I hate preaching the epistles. And one of my congregants said, because the congregation likes it, the epistles. And I just, like, I answered back to him, I never preach stuff that people like, you know, like that is not the role and responsibility of the preacher. I always say, like, if you don't leave our gathering feeling a little unsettled or a bit of dis-ease, then I haven't done my job. And at every church where I've been the pastor, it's shifting the perception of, I come here to be entertained, or I really need to feel like I'm being fed. Are you kidding me? Like, this is upsetting stuff. It should be moving us to a new place. I love what Barbara Brown Taylor says about preaching. She says, like, you know, digging through the dirt and picking up a rock and brushing it off and looking at it from all the different angles and showing it to your people. And I know you all understand this, but when you see the text in a different way, it's like the most invigorating experience, because you know you're working with, like, a living text. And every time that happens for me as a preacher, I think, oh yeah, this is why I do this.
Yeah. So I'm interested, when you were preaching this specific sermon, Hysterical, as you're walking your congregation or walking alongside of them and showing them this fresh new side of it, what did you want them to walk away knowing or even feeling?
I wanted to disrupt the common understanding or reading of the text and offer my people an opportunity to see the text in another way. I also wanted to make a political comment. I really did. On several different things, like the way women are treated in public, the way that men seem to feel obligated or that they have the right to control the reproductive lives of women. You can see through the sermon that I try to put some of those things in, because I really do believe that preachers need to be political. And by that I mean, you know, politics just means the way we order our common life. And if your faith does not have anything to say about how you order your common life, then, like, what, you're like just wasting your time. And so I just always think that if people are out in the world and they come into church on Sunday morning and there's no commentary or conversation or tie or anything to what's going on right outside the walls, then, like, you are making a case for the irrelevance of Christian community. And so, in addition to offering them a new perspective on the text, I wanted them to think about some of these modern issues and try to make some connections with their faith.
Yeah. I'm wondering what that process of preparing to kind of make that both political and theological statement looks like. What does it look like for you to be aware of what's going on around you and to be able to comment on that as a pastor and preacher?
You know, the old saying, like, you have to preach with the Bible in one hand and the New York Times in another. Like, it's really true. And I saw that over and over at Riverside, because that is a pulpit that really calls for, you know, some public commentary. And what was often missing, in my opinion, in the history of that church has been, like, a tie to the substance of faith, because I think those two are deeply tied together. I don't think a lot of preachers do that, and I don't think a lot of preachers do that well. You are going to be speaking to some who really do. So that's exciting. But the other part of that is related to me personally as a preacher. My therapist says, you tend to jump before thinking about where you're jumping. Yeah. And in a lot of ways that has gotten me to some really cool places. And in some ways it's landed me in a a bunch of shit. So that's also my style. And I know that that's not the style of many preachers.
I was going to ask, like, what does that do for you personally? I mean, it's not a lightning rod for the sake of being a lightning rod. But when you say certain things that shake people's core, I mean, you know, you're going to be in some hot water, right? But like, how does that influence your preaching maybe? Or how does it ever stop you? Does it ever get, or does it give you life? Or, you know, because there's other outside factors. I think when you preach, sometimes it's like, well, how are people going to receive this? Or, you know, and I just wonder how you like swim in those waters.
Right. So what the person listening to this sermon does not get to see is like the relationship between me and the people that I'm preaching to. And that, of course, is something that mitigates a lot of the risk. You'll note in the sermon I made some off the cuff remark about my nail polish color. Like, I did that on purpose because I knew there were going to be people who were like pissy about it. And that's just ridiculous. So I decided to like take the reins and like just say it. So some of it is that. And in some ways, many ways, some of the more risque stuff that I was saying from the pulpit would often invite conversation that was very meaningful with people who were uncomfortable and transformational. And that's like the preacher's best wish, right? And then the third thing I'd say is like, anybody who thinks that being a preacher is like, should be a job with no risk is an idiot. Like following Jesus is risky, and the message of the gospel is offensive. And if you're the one out there preaching it, you're going to get shot. And so that's part of it too. Like being really clear about what this calling means.
I actually said, you know, if I don't get an upset email after I preach, then I didn't do.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of just being okay with the call. Yeah, like exactly what you're saying, coming to terms with what the calling really means. Sometimes we put Jesus and the gospel in a nice box where it's nice, and we celebrate Father's Day, and we, you know, and that's not what Jesus calls us to do. So
I hope that we're getting closer to that being a reality all of the time. You know, it's like being a preacher is no longer like the cool thing to be. We don't get automatic respect, and especially those of us who are women. So we are on the edge, and in a way that frees us to be more honest in what we say.
I can just imagine my obituary now. In 2017, on Father's Day, no less, she entered the Riverside pulpit and commenced a feminist rant that made everyone uncomfortable. That day, she was having a fairly good hair day and was sporting a cheery, if risque, nail color.
So you mentioned the red nail polish, and I know for myself, I've like gotten comments before, not at my current appointment, but for my toes showing, like wearing sandals while I'm preaching. So I'm interested in other ways that you may have experienced misogyny as a female pastor.
Oh, I have so many stories, but
how much time do we have? Yeah,
I know.
So like at my first senior pastor at Calvary in DC, I can remember we had a church council meeting early. I was like 32. We had a church council meeting early in my time there. It lasted for an hour. We had an hour and a half discussion about the length of my skirt in worship on Sunday. And, you know, now I would be like, this is ridiculous. Let's move on. But back then I was just like, oh my gosh, we have to talk about this. And then finally I was like, I wear a robe. And then everybody's like, oh yeah, okay, moving on. You know, like stuff like that. And then when I went to Riverside, I thought, this is great, right? You know, like I'm with the first woman. I'm at like this prominent pulpit. I'm not going to have any more trouble with sexism. But I heard stuff all the time. Like, that was a great sermon, but lose the beret. Or I can't tell you how many times on Saturday I went into the nave to prepare for worship and the security guard kicked me out, you know. Miss, you're not allowed in here. You know, it was just constant. And I know you all experience it too. It's real, and it's funny at first, and then it's really annoying. To me, I'm just annoyed by it.
All the stories of like what people have said to me through the years are like running through my brain. And I'm just, someone taught me this. As a woman, you don't want to like call them out on it, you know, or something. You want to be nice, especially the pastor, but it's, tell me what you mean by that. So when someone says, you know, when I was pregnant, someone said, oh, it's too bad you were so cute. Well, tell me what you mean by that. You know, a gentle way of holding people accountable.
Yeah. I've even heard, which is, I think this is so ironic, because it kind of plays on that stereotype of just playing dumb and acting like you don't understand the joke or comment. And that has worked for me.
I'm finishing up a book, and I write an essay in there about the first time I preached a sermon. There was a gentleman who came through the door, and he said, yeah, I think this was a pretty good sermon. But it was just like, watching you is like watching a dog walk on its hind legs.
Oh, gosh.
Tell me what you mean by that.
I didn't even know what to say. Yeah.
What was the feedback like from this sermon? Did you get some feedback?
So some of the best feedback I got was from some preaching professors who told me that they use this sermon in their preaching classes, which I really, that to me is a meaningful accomplishment. I think that by the time, I was 3 years in to my pastorate by that time. So just then coming into sort of like my own as the pastor, and I felt like waiting for those 3 years was the right amount of time so that when I got up, I could talk about the misogyny in this passage and call it out as a sin of ours, and people would actually get it and not think that I was just being a, you know, a whiny woman. The feedback I got from the congregation, except for that one guy who wanted to learn how to be a father, was really, really positive.
Yeah, even throughout, I mean, they're really with you. Like there was, I've never heard so much clapping and cheering and laughing in a sermon before. And so it's, you can tell that they trusted you. And that is the time to kind of say the hard truth. It's like, okay, I've proven to you that I take the gospel seriously. I take the world seriously. And however long that takes, you know, until you have their trust to really, because people can't hear it if they don't trust you. They won't hear it, you know?
But I think it was a combination of like, by that time, I had done so much administrative shifting and cleaning that was long overdue and was really hard. So they had seen me as a leader. And then also, you know, this was in the wake of Donald Trump being elected as president, which to a congregation that's largely Black, LGBTQ, and immigrant, like they were terrified all the time. And, they needed like their pastor to speak to the reality of their lives in that moment. So I think I had built up a level of trust that allowed me to say that. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you, because I find sometimes when I'm sermon writing, there's always something that, not always, but there's always those things you have to cut or the things that I decide maybe to hold back from. Was there something that you wish you would have said or maybe said differently in hindsight?
That's a really good question. I don't think so, but you know, I only sent you the sermons that I really liked. So to be fair,
that's what we asked for.
My sermon writing process is to start living with the text at the beginning of the week and sort of like trying to carry it with me throughout everything that I am doing. And I usually write toward the end of the week. And then I'm always cutting up until the very moment it's delivered. But especially in the Riverside pulpit, I felt like I had to bring like my best work all the time. And so that's one of the sermons I really liked. If I could do something different, I would have spent a little bit more time in the text, probably. But this sermon was actually a bit longer than my normal. I'm always 17 minutes in and out, and this one was a little bit longer. And so I was trying to cut in as many places as I could. I just thought like those stories at the beginning were just had to be put in there because they were so ridiculous.
They were so wild.
It is such a big pulpit. Like if for people who are listening, when you go watch the video, the church is beautiful, but that pulpit looks intimidating. I mean, you know, and then you're talking to predominantly African-American, LGBTQ and immigrant. I mean, yeah, especially in the time of Donald Trump, I mean, in post Donald, you know, how could you not say, but someone told me once, if your knees, that's why we have those pulpits, because they cover our knees from shaking. Because, you know, sometimes telling the truth can be intimidating. But I noticed, too, that another thing that you did really well, the amount of humor that you put throughout the, is that a natural, is that like how you typically preach with the, because people hear better, I think, when they're laughing.
Yeah, I try really hard to bring humor into my sermons and not like, you know, knock, knock, who's there, yeah. But like, you know, like something that can sort of maybe be self-deprecating and also relate to you so that you can be like, oh my gosh, that happened to me too. You know, so that has a way of you allowing me to, or you being able to hear a little bit more of what I'm saying. It's always the worst when you tell a joke and nobody laughs, but humor is often a big part of my preaching, and also trying to hit that balance of vulnerability and authenticity without being like, I'm sitting in a psychiatrist chair, right. You know, like, so that's the fine line. No. I told a story this past Sunday about a terrible mistake I made the first time I ever did a wedding. And everybody in the congregation was like, oh my God, oh my God. It is really a terrible story. And at the door, someone said to me, just, oh my God, thank you so much for telling that story. I can't believe you told it, because, I mean, it was a bad mistake. But I try to do that as a way of opening the gate to the deeper point or a deeper engagement with the text.
My dad always says, if church was funny, I would go, you know. And I always remember Jesus was joyful too. So there is like this laughing with the truth that kind of was modeled for us by Jesus. So
I don't think there are a lot of good preachers out there, to be honest. I mean, just based on my experience teaching preaching, which I will never do again because it was the most horrible experience of my life. But also like our jobs are really busy, right? And we tend to leave the prep of the sermon till the end because we have so many other things coming at us. And yeah, I think in some ways it's not the first priority of a lot of ministers.
Mm. I think it's, so Chelsea knows this about me. I really enjoy stand-up comedy. Now, I don't do it. I'm a preacher, but I enjoy listening to stand-up comedy. And something I hear so many comics talk about is the way many of them work out their jokes is on stage night after night. And through COVID, a lot of them that I listened to have said they felt like they have lost that ability to work out their jokes. Like it's kind of like working out and going to the gym. And I see so many ways that stand up and preaching are so similar. And your sermon was just an example of that, the way you hit the beats, even at some points you pause for laughter. And I just thought it was so beautiful. But I think it's so interesting at the same time that as preachers, we don't have that space to work out night after night. That would be fun and amazing, but that's just not the way the hours work out.
I don't know if you guys do this, but I always practice my sermons out loud before, because some words seem right when they're written, but they don't seem right when they're spoken, or the cadence isn't exactly right. And then I'm also like pause here, like writing all over my sermon. Yeah. But also this past Sunday was our first Sunday back in person. And I wanted to cry after the sermon because it was so, such a relief to have like actual people out there. Like I always think of preaching as a conversation. And when you're preaching to a camera, it's terrible.
It is.
Did they wear masks?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I have found that we are outside, but people have been wearing masks. And it's really hard to preach. Even, I mean, it's much better than a camera, but preaching to people, you don't know if they're smiling or laughing. Okay. You know, it is a little bit. Yeah. It's
different. Yeah, even if someone like cocks their head, you're like, is this interest or how are they feeling? You get kind of awake.
Yeah. Right.
Have you
right.
been preaching from the pulpit to a camera or some in other ways during the pandemic?
Yes, from the pulpit. So I'm at National City Christian Church now. This is the National Church of Disciples of Christ. And so it's a big cathedral, also with a big, huge pulpit that is very meaningful to the people who attend church there. And I think in some ways they would have a hard time hearing a sermon from the floor. You know, the pulpit is really important. So, yeah.
Well, and it is always learning the church and the congregation and seeing where you fit into that, you know, not being the mold, but also knowing what's important to keep in. So,
yeah, I haven't. So I haven't met most of the people in my congregation. I've been there a little over a year because of COVID. So that's hard too, right? When you're preaching and you don't know who your audience is.
Every time we have a guest preacher, I'm always like, this person's amazing. And, you know, and then I'm like, oh, I've heard that. Like, I've heard them do better. And it's really hard to come into a space where you don't know people and pick it up. You know, I've been at this church for 10 years and I feel like I'm just now hitting, and I'm not the senior. I only preach like once a month, but I'm just now starting to hit a groove with like, I know where they are. I know where I am. I know what gifts I bring. I know, you know, I know when to push. I know when to share, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
At the beginning, it was like, here's my deepest fear. You know, like at the end, I was just like in my therapist's office, like way too vulnerable.
That's so funny. I can remember when I came to Calvary, I had only preached 4 sermons before they hired me. They never asked me that in the interview, so I never told them. So by the end of the 3rd week, I was like, I've said everything I learned in seminary in these first 3 sermons. I have nothing else to say.
And I'm done.
It's wild.
It is. Preaching is just such an interesting, I think Claire was kind of getting there, but it's like, you know, you preach it and then it's done and then you're on to the next week. You know, you don't even really have time to say goodbye to it, or, you know, it's like, it is such a work of art. And then you spend so much time and thought and energy and then it's done. And then it's like, take a nap and on to the next week. It's like this constantly moving. So how do you energize how do you stay on top of your game?
Well, I plan my sermons out for a year in advance. So I have this group of pastor friends. There are 6 of us. We've been going away for a week in the summer for this 17 or 18 years. And when I come back from that week, I have like the whole year planned out. And so I sort of savor things ahead of time. Like this November, I noticed a lot of stories about women, like Esther and Ruth and in the lectionary. So I have a 4-week series called The Handmaid's Tale. I'm so excited about it. Right. But I think that's one of the things I enjoyed so much about the Riverside pulpit, because there were people listening on the radio. There were people listening in other countries online, and the conversation about the sermons would continue longer than normal. And that felt really good to me. Like, I put my heart and soul into this and I'm glad it's going somewhere. But yes, it is a relentless cycle of Sundays for sure.
Yeah. Well, and also to write them in somewhat of a community where you go away and have space and time, that would be helpful. You have to send us the link to the sermon series. That's amazing. I love that.
Where did you teach preaching? I'm interested.
I taught preaching at Wesley Theological Seminary when I was a pastor here in town. And I've done some like preaching intensives and I do some one-on-one coaching, but I really like to work with like good preachers. I think that preaching is a gift that some people have more of and some people don't. But like any gift in your life, whether you hone it makes a huge difference. And so to find a preacher who has a gift and then to help them develop that is really energizing for me. I just like listening to beginning preachers in preaching class is really, really hard for me. I didn't like it.
I'm thinking of my first sermon. I cried in the middle of it in preaching class. That wasn't the best.
Yeah, yeah. Same. You know, we all start somewhere, and then God bless the congregations that watch us and endure us honing our craft, right?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a craft.
I'm the interim at National City, and I'll be there probably for another year. And I have just really loved being an interim because you don't have to worry about keeping your job, and you can like do all the hard things, and it's okay. And even say some hard things. And I just sort of see my job as working for the next pastor. And so it's been a lovely, healing, wonderful experience for me. And I've been thinking, especially in advance of this conversation, like how sad it would be for me if I didn't get to preach regularly after this. So I don't know what's next. We'll see.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Is it, do you like being in a church, a specific church, or would it be, you know, public theologian preaching all over? And
well, I think, you know, I've spent 25 years of my career turning around these big historical institutions, and that takes a lot of energy and a lot of, I just don't know if I have it anymore, you know? So I'm trying to pay attention to that. You know, Riverside is a very painful break, and that was, you know, like, okay, I don't know if I believe in God anymore. I certainly don't believe in the church, you know? So like doing the healing work of that has been a big part of my last couple of years, but I'm working on a side project called Invested Faith, which is a way of institutions that are dying, repurposing their assets and distributing them to social and spiritual entrepreneurs who are trying to do church in a new way, kind of like what you guys are doing. So that has a lot of my energy and attention right now, but I would miss the preaching for sure.
We're going to ask everybody this, but what do you see as the role of preaching?
So part of what I said before about how people leave the sermon to the last is like a pet peeve of mine, because to me, that is like one of the most important pieces of the liturgy. I mean, I'm a Baptist, so of course, but also like, this is the only time you have the whole community in one space hearing the same thing, right? And you are the resident theologian of the community. So if you are trying to shape this community and lead toward a vision, this is your tool. This is your most effective tool. And so don't lay it down and don't ignore it, like use it. So I think the role of preaching is principally to communicate the theology of the community in a way that shapes the community. I would also say, and I learned this at Riverside, that the role of preaching is to be prophetic in a way that pushes your people to a different place, that says the hard thing. I mean, it's quite an honor and responsibility to have that platform. And we need to take it seriously. Yeah.
Would you say that your congregation, either at Riverside or even now, do they understand that role? Because I know sometimes there can be a difference between how the preacher understands the role versus the congregation.
Yes, I would say at every congregation where I've come in as a principal preacher, I've worked to redefine the way the congregation understands the preaching role. It's funny that you asked me about being called Pastor Amy at the beginning, because that relates directly to my experience at Riverside, where that congregation is used to celebrity preachers, and you know they applaud after every sermon. It's like it's kind of like a show, and the preacher's up there in that high pulpit, and they're called Dr. Butler, and you know, and that makes it easy to have separation and to not really engage with what the preacher's saying. So when I went, I specifically asked them to start calling me Pastor Amy, because I wanted them to feel like they knew me and they were invested in what I was saying. And So that was a shift that I tried to make at Riverside. Here at National City, I want to set the bar really high for what they should expect from their pastor. You know, I think their past has been a series of, you know, sermons that were sort of incidental or secondary to the music and the big organ, right? And I want them to get used to really good preaching and to expect it in their next preacher. So I think every preacher, when you come into a community, you have to assess how the people understand what you're doing, and then you have to shape it to make it what it needs to be.
Mm. Thanks for sharing. That's really beautiful.
Big shoes to fill coming in after you.
I know. I am brand new to this. I just graduated from seminary, and so I'm soaking in all of the wisdom from both you and Chelsea.
That's so exciting. I've had the opportunity to meet some really amazing young potential next pastors of National City, and I feel excited for them. And like meeting people like you makes me feel so hopeful about the future of the church. So I'm so grateful.
That was going to be, I know we're coming up on time, but that is my question that I love asking people. What is your hope for the future church?
You know, we are watching this huge decline of the institution in America, for which I say, amen, thank you, Jesus, because it really frees us up to do probably more what we were meant to do. I don't think the church is going anywhere, because being human means we need community. And we need a place to ask these bigger, deeper questions that are too scary to ponder on our own. So the church will be present in some form. The question for us is whether we will have the courage to show up where those places are. That's one of the reasons why I started Invested Faith, because there were so many young ministers who I met who like graduate from seminary, go to their three-point charge in the middle of Kansas, want to stab themselves in the eye, and then they leave and they start a brewery or they start a coffee shop or whatever, you know, just this community building work they're called to do. And I suspect the church is going to be showing up more and more in those places. And I want to think of a way for us to support that, encourage it, be there, and help it grow.
I think you're so right. I went to happy hour with some girlfriends last night, and we had these deep, spiritual, intimate conversations. And they're like, I don't have anywhere else. And they go to church. I don't have anywhere else that I can have these conversations. And I was like, we need to do, like, this is like soul work. Like, I left, I said, I feel like my soul just got a hug. And also, like, I have a list of books I need to read now for, you know, and like other, so it's just, I do think it's those third places, the coffee shop, brewery, and all that. So,
but we're scared, you know, like now you got me on my soapbox. But like the institutional church has been shaped by a theology of scarcity that keeps us from being open to all the possibilities that God is creating in this world. And that is so shameful. You know, what would happen if we lived as if we believed in this God of abundance? There's enough for everybody. You know, the church can show up in places we never expected. And I still believe there are enough people who understand their faith in that way, that we will get somewhere. I hope so.
I'm with you. I feel hopeful. I feel excited. You know, the possibilities are just, and I do kind of think some parts need knocked out. You know, need knocked down for us to see it. But I'm so excited. This time to be a faith leader, a Christian, it's so exciting. I think these shifts are going to be, I'm so happy I'm a pastor in this time.
I am too, until I tell my parents what I'm doing and they just look at me like, what? Yeah. You know, like, yeah. But again, isn't that our job, to be saying the thing that people just don't quite get and feel a little offended by?
Well, you're planting the seeds, and then they'll remember in a couple years. I'm like, oh, I think Pastor Amy said that thing. Yeah.
My coach says, you're answering a question nobody's asking yet. Yay.
That's great. Well, Pastor Amy, thank you so much for sharing your sermons and your time and your wisdom. Like Claire said, we're just soaking it in, and we're so thrilled that our audience gets to soak it in and gets to hear from you. And we're so excited to point them to your sermons and your work. because you really do have this beautiful way of holding the scripture and the world and ourselves in this way that is humorous, but also in this way that pushes us to be better. So it's such a gift. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Collective Tables Sermon Podcast Hour. May you continue to encounter the mystery of a God ever present.